But then when the hero or the heroine bogs down in the middle, sometimes we lose the courage to continue with the story, to go through all the adventures that the heroine or the hero is going to have to go through in order to get to that happy ending. And the simple fact of courage is it is fundamental to success on the spiritual path, that we're just not going to be deterred by anything that happens. In our affirmations every week, Swamiji defines courage in this way. There are three kinds of human courage, he says: blind, passive, and dynamic. Blind courage doesn't count the cost until it finds itself faced horror-stricken with the bill. Passive courage is the strength of will to adjust to reality, whatever it may be. And dynamic courage is the strength of will not only to accept reality, but to confront it with another reality of one's own making. And then there is a fourth kind of courage, not human, but divine. Divine courage comes from living in the awareness of God's presence within, and in the realization that he is the sole reality. Live more in him, for nothing and no one can touch what you really are. These are marvelous ideas, aren't they? Every time we read this on Sunday, I always want a minute to comment on it. Sometimes when we start on the spiritual path, we think that blind courage is what is called for. But in a very real sense, it isn't. Blind courage is the courage that you have without common sense, without counting the cost. And the way Swami describes that elsewhere is when you presume too much on God's grace before you have actually experienced that power. It used to be manifested in the early years of Ananda in a very sort of interesting way. People would decide to live without heat. They would decide to live without shoes. They would decide to live without eating anything but brown rice. And you would be torn between a sort of awesome, an awed amazement that somebody could even imagine doing such a thing, and the absolute annoyance of the sheer stupidity of it, and, you know, the incurable bronchitis that would result, and then all the difficulties that that would cause. So blind courage sometimes attracts us because it has a certain drama to it that seems more fun than the plodding everyday life. But it isn't as much of a virtue as we think it is, because this is a long-distance race. That's how Master puts it. This is not a sprint. And so if you're sprinting, you can afford to just give everything and then recover afterwards. But there's no finish line after 100 yards on this. You sprint that 100 yards and literally the horizon just moves out in front of you. When we used to drive through the deserts of Texas when I was a child, we had hours and hours of these straight roads through the sand dunes, and you would get that water mirage. And as a child, endlessly, I would try to, you know, will the car to reach the edge of that shimmering place that the light was creating. But of course, it would always move in front of you. And of course, to a certain extent, the spiritual path is like that, but not in a negative way. It's like that in the sense that because the achievement is infinite, you never reach the end of it. Master was asked, is there any end to evolution? His response was, no, we keep on evolving until we achieve endlessness. It's such an extraordinary thought, which is to say the whole mindset that's trying to finish the spiritual path is never going to serve us. Patience is the fastest way to God. And this brings us to the second kind of courage. And the second kind of courage, he calls it passive, which doesn't sound as positive as it actually is. Passive courage is able to perceive things as they are and adjust. And that's really the courage that is the key point on the spiritual path, because the reality that we end up having to adjust to is twofold. One is the nature of the spiritual path. A dear friend who's relatively new on the path has been talking to me about the fact, of course, because she's always excelled at everything that she's done, she wants to excel now at the spiritual path. And to understand that excelling on the spiritual path is the second kind of courage, which is to realize that it took me a very long time to build up all this karma. And now that it has occurred to me that building up all this karma was not such a good idea as it seemed at the time, you can't just snap your fingers and have it go away. And the passive courage that he describes is not passive in the sense that it lacks willpower, but it's simply you must adjust. There's just nothing that you can actually do to make that be different. It's just going to take that kind of, courage, is endurance. That's the word I was looking for. Just the sheer endurance of putting one foot in front of the other, regardless of what comes back to me. And that's a huge kind of courage. So often people say, well, I stopped doing this because I didn't get any results. I stopped doing that because I didn't get any results. Well, honey, welcome to the club of no results. It's just the way it is. It's not something that you can, as Master said, continually pull the plant up, look at the roots and see if it's growing. A great deal of the time, you must be like a kshatriya. And the kshatriya is the warrior king and the soldier who simply says, I have to get from here to there. And they're shooting at me, and it may be difficult, and in fact, I may not even make it, but I just have to do it. These are my orders. And to a certain extent, as devotees, we just have to take our orders from the teachings of the guru. And there's an art as well as a science to it. But nonetheless, we simply do it because the master has told us that it will work. And if we, as he put it, and this is such a beautiful phrase, if we persevere to the end, and he just says persevere to the end, he said, when you die, I or one of the other masters will be there to greet you. And you see, it's an entirely different concept of success. People think of success as the accolades of the multitudes, the love of the people, the manifestation of great powers. But Master defines it as perseverance. And this is where the passive courage to not quit is a very noble kind of courage. But then Master Swamiji adds here the third kind of courage, which is to meet reality with another reality of your own creation. And that is the secret of prosperity and the real secret of success. Whatever is in front of me, I just find a creative way to keep going. So the passive courage of perseverance is enlivened by the dynamic courage, as he calls it. And that dynamic courage finds a way to refresh your sadhana, to renew your inspiration, to find new interest in another piece of reading, to memorize more of the whispers from eternity, that takes the science of just putting one foot in front of the other, as the guru told me to do, and makes it dynamic by my own willpower and involvement. And dynamic courage is what makes the spiritual path a joy. Because, well, here we are, and we've lost all our money, and we have to start all over again. Well, here we are, and we've been meditating for 25 years, and the samadhi that I thought it would have now doesn't really seem to have been delivered in the way that I expected it to. Well, here I am with an aging body, and none of the self-identifications that I thought were possible are going to prove to be true. So with dynamic courage, I create a new reality for myself. I was helping a woman once who was suffering a great deal from reality. It's the only thing I can call it. She was really suffering from reality. She suffered from what Swami called in the first affirmation of the year, the affirmation on success. He says, failure is not always a bad thing if it cures you of your attachment to false ambitions. Very interesting phrase. False ambitions that are not based on a realistic appraisal of our own self. And this woman that I was working with had suffered from false ambitions. She failed to perceive her own nature and therefore imagined herself capable of things that she was realizing she would never be capable of. However, of course, she had sterling virtues, but she was suffering from that. So I encouraged her to have dynamic courage and simply reinvent herself. And so we decided that she would become an SHSD, a simple, humble, serviceful devotee. And she sort of wrote it down, SHSD. I said, whenever you feel anxious about your spiritual life, and you see now this is more than adjusting, this is using dynamic courage to confront one reality with a new reality. All right, so it turns out I won't be what I thought I would be, but I will be a simple, humble, serviceful devotee. And what a great joy that would be. And I said to her, I said, who are the people you like most around you? Is it the ones who are puffed up with their own talent and importance? Or is it the SHSDs that you really enjoy? And of course, when you think about it, that's the truth, isn't it? Because then that brings us into the fourth kind of courage, which is the grace of God. And all of our necessity to dig deep and find this courage at all, when you think about it, is because in some way we feel ourselves separate from the presence of God. That something in our life makes us feel separate from the presence of God. Because if we're living in the presence of God, what is the need for courage even? Because where else would we want to be? We are exactly where we want to be. And so it comes as a grace, but it's also a way of exercising our willpower to make ourselves fearless and to give ourselves the power to persevere. Here I am, as much as I ever will be, in the presence of God. And if that is my only reality, then what is there to struggle against even? Of course, what is there to fear? But also, what is there to struggle against? And then the courage becomes automatic, because as a simple, humble, serviceful devotee, all I want to do is please God, and He will give me the strength to do that. Now, with those thoughts behind us, I want to read a little bit from The Path. This is not an unchallenging passage, but since the subject was courage, I thought I would choose it. This is on the chapter called Renunciation. Whether by coercion or by love, it is not unusual for people who dedicate their lives to high ideals to encounter opposition from well-meaning friends and relatives. For between selfless idealism and worldliness, there exists a fundamental incompatibility. Worldliness lives in the constant expectation of personal rewards and benefits, of desires satisfied, of values received. I'm going to comment there. It's very important to realize that worldliness is not what you do, but worldliness is the attitude with which you do it. And the distinction he's making here is not between any forms of activity or ways of life, but the worldliness is to think about what the ego is going to get. Idealism scorns personal benefit, renounces selfish desires, and views life rather in terms of value given. It finds its highest benefit in the very act of sacrifice and considers that a true gain, which worldliness views only as a loss. Fanaticism is the verdict commonly pronounced by worldly people on any but the most pallid expressions of idealism. And if that verdict isn't forthcoming, ulterior motives is the backup charge. All the while, however, worldliness feels vaguely uneasy in the presence of selfless dedication, as though sensing in it some hidden threat to all that it holds dear. For the soul of every human being knows that its true home is not in this world, but in infinity. Perfect representatives of either side are, of course, rare. Worldliness and renunciation are qualities that people manifest to varying degrees, but no single human quality ever suffices to define any individual. Worldly people may even, in one part of their natures, applaud heroic self-sacrifice in others. And many, of course, are no strangers to self-sacrifice themselves. In fact, they sacrifice much for their own families and their more worldly ideals. Moreover, strange twist of human nature, it is frequently the worldly man who most sternly censures the renunciate who falls from his ideals. And of course, the renunciate, for his part, must do constant battle in himself against worldly self-interest. But the fact remains that between worldliness and renunciation, considered as abstractions, there is not and can never be the slightest compatibility. As the Bible puts it, whoever will be a friend of the world is the enemy of God. Of course, the dichotomy he's making there is selfishness versus self-sacrifice. The worldly person asks first of life, what do I want? The devotee is indifferent to questions of personal egoic fulfillment and asks only, what does God want? Renunciation is an inner state of consciousness, not an outward act. All men, whether married or single, who love God and want to know Him, must reconcile themselves to living for Him alone. The pathway of the heart is too narrow for the ego and God to walk it together. One of them must step aside and make way for the other. Living for God, Yogananda said, is martyrdom. Martyrdom of the ego. Martyrdom of self-will and selfishness. Martyrdom of all that worldliness clings to so desperately. But the true devotee comes in time to see that this isn't martyrdom at all, since its end is blissful freedom in the only true self, God. We are sons of the infinite. Anything that binds us to a limited existence desecrates this divine image within ourselves. Renunciation is no abject self-deprivation, but a glorious affirmation of the universe of joy that is our birthright. As St. John of the Cross put it, in order to arrive at having pleasure in everything, desire pleasure in nothing. In order to arrive at possessing everything, desire to possess nothing. In order to arrive at being everything, desire to be nothing. In order to arrive at the knowledge of everything, desire to know nothing. the essence of renunciation is to relinquish the poverty consciousness of a beggar and the clutching attitude of a miser towards things, places, people, experiences. In short, the limitations of this world, and to offer oneself constantly at the feet of infinity. So, let us have Swamiji now sing to us several songs affirming these qualities of courage and renunciation, and then we'll meditate for about 35 or 40 minutes. The qualities that we're working with, courage, now positive thinking, even-mindedness, God alone, you hear them all in Master's voice. Just in the sheer sound of his voice, you hear it. Positive thinking. As we think, so we become. And as we think, so our lives and circumstances become also. From the divine consciousness come answers to all our questions and solutions to all our problems. It is in lower consciousness that confusion reigns. Think positively in everything you do, for in that way you help to attune yourself to the divine flow. One who is inwardly in tune with grace finds all things harmonious and beneficial being attracted to him. Positive thinking, combined with the sense of divine attunement, is never presumptuous, for it draws its power not from the ego, but from the consciousness of God's joy within. This is the highest form of positive thinking. And it's very important, much more than we realize, that, as Swami puts it, thoughts are things, and every thought that you put out is as tangible as if you were putting money in the bank or food in your stomach or resumes out on the internet. The power of this universe is really the vibration of our own consciousness. Now we have to combine this with the courage that we were talking about earlier to accept and dynamically be creative with reality as it is. So you have to understand that our positiveness is not that our desires will always be fulfilled. Our positiveness is the absolute certain knowledge that God is always with us. And therefore, whatever it might look like to me, it doesn't really matter, because this is being sent to me by God for my own good, and it might not be positive in itself on the small frame that we're looking, small window that we're looking at. And it's not dishonest to perceive things as they are. So the positive has to come because we see it on many levels. That right now this is challenging. Right now I cry myself to sleep at night. Right now I'm not sleeping because I don't know how this is going to resolve. It's very important in our relationship with God that we be absolutely sincere about what our true feelings are. But then what we have to put in is we have to put in something underneath that. And what we put in underneath it is, thy will, not mine, be done. And if God sent this to me, then God also plans to give me the solution to it. And that's where our dynamic will comes in. And this is how Swami says, when we live in the consciousness of God and attuned to him, then everything comes out harmonious and beneficial. Harmonious and beneficial from the point of view of the divine. And the art of positive thinking then is to see it from God's point of view. I want to share a little bit from the path before we stop and do this initiation. This is from the chapter on reincarnation, which is really the greatest reason for positive thinking, is because you see it never ends. So if it doesn't work out now, it'll work out later. And if you think you're getting away with it now, it'll catch up with you later. But the attitude of reincarnation, I really don't know how people can live without it. Because what it tells you is that my devotee is never lost. Whatever's happening, even if I fail completely right now, there's no reason to be even slightly concerned. Because I'll get to try again. And even if I lose everything now, it's no reason to worry about it because I'll get to try again. And this kind of irrepressible optimism comes to you. Because you know sooner or later it's going to work out. So this is a story about Master. First, a boatload of fishermen in Encinitas had had a bad day. After hours of work and very little to show for it, they were ready to go home. Paramhansa Yogananda happened to be strolling on the beach when they brought their boat in. "You are giving up?" he inquired. "Yeah," they replied. "No fish." "Why don't you try just once more?" the master suggested. Something in the tone of his voice made them heed his advice. Going out once more, they got a large haul. And thus was added another puzzling item to the growing legend in the local community of Encinitas about the strange, kindly Swami, around whom things seem somehow always to happen for the best. To me, this story, which I heard indirectly from some of the townsfolk there, illustrates a basic truth of human life, one that Master often emphasized. No matter how many times a person fails, he need never accept failure as destiny's final judgment on him. We have a right, as children of the infinite, he said, to God's infinite bounty. Failure is never God's will for us. It is merely a temporary condition we impose on ourselves through some flaw in our attunement with cosmic law. By repeated efforts to succeed, we gradually refine that attunement. "Try just once more," Master said. If our basic intentions are spiritually lawful, failure simply means we haven't yet succeeded. Life, in other words, gives us our failures as stepping stones to success. In the case of those fishermen, Master's blessings proved a necessary aid, in the sense that they helped attune those men's efforts more quickly to what they were already on the way to accomplishing. Had the men not been ready for such a blessing, he would not have given it, which is another way of saying they would not have attracted it. The sensitivity with which one tries just once more, rather than the mere act of repetition, is the real key to success. There are some people who succeed quickly, whereas others struggle unsuccessfully for years. Attunement is the secret. Genius depends far more on attunement than on hard work or intellectual brilliance. And of all existing sorts of attunement, the highest is to be aware of God's power acting through us. Our ineluctable destiny is, sooner or later, to find God, for he is our only reality. Reincarnation, then, is a reassuring doctrine for those who wonder, "Will I ever make it?" All of us have an infinite number of chances to improve and to reach perfection. The story of the fisherman is a symbol of God's everlasting willingness to give men that one more chance they need in order to obtain everything they desire from his ocean of abundance. By extension, this story suggests that God's forgiveness call it rather his loving expectation of us, is eternal. Let's meditate now just a few minutes, and then we'll ask those who are going to be initiated to come forward. Our third quality is even-mindedness, courage, positive thinking, even-mindedness. Many people confuse progress with movement and with outward change. Thus, the more dust of excitement they can stir up, the more productive they feel they are. The more they get swept up into a happy mood when things go well, the better they imagine things have gone. And their answer to every slump is to cast about for some other thing to sweep them high once more. Such lives are like cars driven over deeply rutted roads. Their movement is almost as much up and down as it is forward. With even-mindedness, progress is a straight, not a jagged line. Progress, however, should mean, above all, progressive understanding. Even-mindedness bestows clarity of perception, which is the ability to see things as they really are, undistorted by emotional bias. The heart is the source of likes and dislikes. And that's why blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. For once the conflicting cross currents of the ego in the heart are calmed, then the mind is automatically calmed. Swamiji says, people talk about calming the mind in meditation, but what you actually have to calm is the heart. Because once the feelings are calm, the mind remains very calm. So it's the reactive process. This I like, this I don't like, this I want, this I don't want, this I need to have come to me, this I want to push away. That comes from the heart's taking the oneness of life and buying into the duality of it. And that's what disturbs the mind when you meditate. All the desires and frustrated feelings and everything that comes up. So even-mindedness is simply to control the reactive process. It doesn't mean not to experience and feel things deeply. It means rather always, though, to see in whatever's happening the depth of the ocean. And even if you're riding the surfing of the waves, your sense of it is always that it's the deep ocean that you're part of. And you can see, you will see. If you allow yourself to live that way, your feelings become far more sensitive rather than being dulled. You actually gain the capacity to experience on a much more refined level because you're not always confusing the situation by imposing your preferences on it. Deep feeling. Deep, calm feeling, Master says, is pure intuition. And so just by the even-minded approach to life, yes, this is difficult, yes, this is wonderful, yes, this is difficult, yes, this is wonderful, but underneath it, just keep an even moving forward of your energy. Progress, Swami writes there, is deepening understanding. One of the manifestations of God is wisdom. And so by even-mindedness, we can observe and we get to a deeper and deeper level of understanding of who we are, what we are, even on a human way, what's moving us if we remain a little more even-minded. And in that, true progress comes. This chapter is work versus meditation. Master talking about positive energy, overcoming moods, and so on. Master, in his effort to break us of half-hearted willingness, what he called one horsepower energy, urged us always to keep a positive outlook and to affirm possibilities rather than weaken them with too many so-called reasonable objections. I remember his greeting to me one day. "How are you, Walter?" "Well," I began. "That's good," he interposed promptly. Nipping in the bud, what he saw was only a mild case of vapors. Never supportive of us in our moods, he urged us to banish them firmly with vigorous positive affirmations. "I suffer when you have moods," he said once, "for then I see that Satan gets a hold of you." Fay, which was Diamata's name, when she was 17, was inclined to be somewhat moody. "If you want to be unhappy," Master once said to her, "no one in the world can make you happy. And if you determine to be happy, no one in the world will be able to make you unhappy." She once told me, "Master wouldn't even allow us to be around him when we had moods." Moods weren't often my specific problem, but I remember one that ambushed me one day, and the helpful method I discovered for combating it. It was in February or March of 1949. Master had been away from Mount Washington several weeks, and I hadn't seen him in all that time. I was beginning to feel his absence keenly. Finally, he returned. The next day, word came down to me to get someone to carry a 5-gallon bottle of drinking water up to his kitchen. Eagerly, I appropriated the job to myself. Arriving upstairs with the bottle, I could hear Master dictating a letter in his sitting room. Hoping to attract his attention, I rattled the bottle and made as much noise as I felt I decently could for a job which called for a minimum of tumult. Master paid no attention. "He doesn't care that I miss him," I thought, plunging suddenly into a violent depression. "I'm just a worker to him, not a disciple." I rushed on to brood over the unfeeling nature of this world, where nobody really cares for anyone else. Moments later, I made an abrupt about-face. "No, Master cares, but he sees I'm such a hopeless case that he figures he might as well give up pouring water into this bottomless pit." On and on my mind churned. I tried reasoning with myself. "Look here, he's obviously busy. Why should he drop everything just for you?" "Yeah," retorted my recalcitrant mind. I imagined he said, "Look out, here comes that worthless disciple, Walter. Quick, let me dictate a letter as an excuse so I don't have to call him in here." Clearly, reason wasn't going to pull me out of my mental whirlpool. Indeed, reason's tendency is to support any feeling that happens to be uppermost in the mind. "Do you like being moody?" I demanded of my mental citizens. "No," came the chorus, unanimously, except for one or two grumblers in the background. "Very well then, boys, if reason won't do it, let's see if changing our level of consciousness will do the trick." I went down to my meditation cave and there plunged my mind deeply at the Christ Center between the eyebrows. 5 minutes was all it took. By the end of that time, my mood was so uplifted and positive that I no longer needed to affirm anything. "But of course he's busy," I thought. "Hasn't he told us often that our real communion with him is inside in meditation? And what if all his disciples tried selfishly to take up his time? He wouldn't have any time left over to complete his writings, which will help thousands." In Autobiography of a Yogi, Master wrote, "Thoughts are universally and not individually rooted. We don't create them. We only receive them depending on our level of consciousness." "Sir," someone asked Master, "what causes moods?" "Moods," he replied, "are caused by past overindulgence in sense pleasures and consequent over-satiety and disgust. If you indulge your moods," he added warningly, "you will reinforce the mind's swing back again toward sense pleasures. For that is how the law of duality works. It moves constantly back and forth like a pendulum between opposite states of awareness. If, by not giving in to moods, you remove energy from one end of the pendulum swing, you will find the hold that the senses have on you at the opposite end will weaken as well. Master's help was available to anyone who called to him mentally in meditation. Here he was the guide, ever subtly inspiring us according to the measure of our receptivity to make the right kind of spiritual effort. Sometimes, too, when we met him during the day, he would admonish us on some point concerning our meditations. Indeed, he watched over us in all ways. It never ceased to amaze me that with so many disciples to look after, he could be so perfectly aware of the needs of each one. "I go through your souls every day," he told us. "If I see something in you that needs correcting, I tell you about it. Otherwise, I say nothing." On another occasion, he said, "I have lived the lives of each one of you. Many times, I go so deep into a person at night that when I wake up in the morning, I think I am that person." So now we have a few songs by Swamiji before we meditate. It's God alone. In this book, it's written as God remembrance. To remember God means not only to think of him constantly, but to realize that finding him is an act of remembrance. For it is from him that we have come. When the clouds of delusion evaporate from our minds, what will be left is what was there always, hidden behind the clouds, the blazing sun of divine consciousness. One should not strain nor reach outward mentally to think of God. Know that he has been yours always, nearer than your nearest thoughts and feelings, nearer than the very prayers you offer him. Think not merely about him, think to him. Share with him your passing feelings, your idlest fancy. Talk with him. Practice his presence, at first perhaps for minutes a day, then for hours, and then all the time. Probably the hardest thing for all of us to realize is just exactly what's written there. He puts it so simply, you don't have to strain mentally. That the art of realizing God is the deepest form of relaxation. Master talks about just cutting off all of that outward flowing energy and realizing that everything that we're trying to find in that way is already present as soon as we calm down enough and stop reaching out. It's a very, very strange paradox. And it's one that we just have to practice and practice and practice. You saw Master, you heard Master there. He just couldn't stop giving. He would sort of finish and then he would go again and then he would have another thought and he would go again. And you could feel him. He didn't even want to wait for people to speak after him. He just wanted to pour the energy out. Sometimes Sri Ramakrishna would talk all day, all night. There were times when he would just talk and talk and talk just because he had so much to pour out. Remember how Master said it took very little to prompt Sri Yukteswar to have a philosophical discussion that would go all night. And you would think in terms sometimes of these masters being silent, but the other side of it is that they're pouring that vibration out to us. That's what you hear. Sometimes listening to Master, partly it's the recordings, but also it's almost overwhelming. the intensity of his the power that he wants to put into us, and our job is exactly what Saint John said. It's just a question of receiving that energy. And to be very honest, you know, you listen to him speak and you can see why it wouldn't be that easy to receive that energy. Because it requires that you lift yourself to a level that's of a higher vibration than where we would naturally be. That's the story that's told of one of his disciples demanding of him cosmic consciousness. And finally, Master just looking at the man and saying, can you take it? Could you really handle that much energy flowing through your system? And the disciple had to realize, of course he couldn't. And that's why he didn't have that state of consciousness. So listening to Master's voice gives us a feeling of what that vibration is. And power is an aspect of the divine. Just how much power there is there. And we imagine that we have to tense ourselves to have that much power. But the fact of the matter is we have to relax from all the obstructions, all the other issues of self-concern and self-protection and, you know, what will I lose? What will I gain? What will others think of me? All of that. We actually relax our grip on all those outward preoccupations and just fall deeper and deeper and deeper into the inner self. And then there's nothing overwhelming about it. It's only overwhelming to us when it hits up against that which we're squeezing tight. But once those obstructions are removed, then that energy just is our very own. This is the chapter simply called Paramhansa Yogananda. This is one of my very favorite pieces of this entire book. It talks about how to relate to Master and how Master relates to us. Friendship in God, surely, was the key to our relationship with Master. It implied no easygoing relationship such as worldly people enjoy with one another, but demanded of us rather the utmost that we had to give. The friendship our Guru extended to us was to our souls. To reciprocate in kind meant to strive unceasingly to meet him on that divine level. Those who clung to the desire for ego gratification could not coax from him a compromise in the pure quality of his friendship. If a disciple flattered him, Master would gaze at him quietly as if to say, I will not desecrate the love I bear you by accepting this level of communication. Always he held out to us the highest ideal to which each of us might aspire. Such perfect love imposes the most demanding of all disciplines, for ultimately it asks nothing less of the disciple than the total gift to God of himself. I used to pray to Master, teach me to love you as you love me. Chatting with a group of us one day, after hours in the main office, he looked at me penetratingly and said, how can the little cup expect to hold the whole ocean of love? First, it has to expand and become as big as the ocean. The Indian scriptures state that when the soul has released its hold on egoic individuality, it merges into the ocean of spirit, becoming one with it. While most of us loved Master from varying degrees of ego identification, his love for us was without limit, indeed cosmic. To ordinary human beings, such love is inconceivable. "I killed Yogananda long ago," he used to say. "No one dwells in this temple now but God." His love for us was God's love, manifested through his human form. "Whenever I look at you," Norman once wrote Master in a note, "I see only the Divine Mother." "Then behave accordingly," Master replied with impersonal calmness when next they met. This was no modest disclaimer, but only an objective acceptance of things as they were. Yogananda was the humblest man I ever knew, yet it was humility only in the sense that there was no ego there at all, not in the sense that his manner was self-deprecating. Indeed, when someone once praised him for his humility, I recall the simple answer he gave: "How can there be humility when there is no consciousness of ego?" In essence, our relationship with him was not only a friendship in God, but with God, whose love alone he expressed to us. Always, with firm resolution, he turned toward the divine all the love we gave him. Whenever we touched his feet, in the manner customary among Indian disciples to their guru, he held his right hand reverently at his forehead, extending the fingers upward to indicate that he directed our devotion to God. And if anyone's affection for him displayed the slightest attachment, he often became distant and reserved until that person had understood it was God's love alone that he extended to us. Part of the basis for Master's amazing charisma was the fact that, seeing his infinite beloved in everyone, he awakened them to an inchoate belief in their own goodness. With the impersonality of true greatness, he never accepted the thought others projected onto him that he was essentially different from them. Once when we were serving him, he remarked, "You are all so kind to me with your many attentions." One of the disciples exclaimed, "Oh no, Master, it is you who are kind to us." "God is helping God," Master replied with a sweet smile. "That is the nature of his cosmic drama." I remember the evening that he recorded some of his chants for public release. Partway through that recording session, I was obliged to leave for a class I was giving at the Hollywood Church. On my return, I found Master standing outside on the lawn, listening to one of the chants being played back to him. "What lightning flash glimmers in thy face, Mother? Seeing thee, I am thrilled through and through." Again and again he had the recording played. Presently he began almost to dance, swaying to and fro ecstatically, his arms stretched sideways, waving to the rhythm of the music. He was blissfully engrossed in the beauty of Divine Mother, whom he perceived as wondrous light spreading out to infinity. I was deeply moved. Afterwards, as he was taking leave of our little group, he said quietly, "I see all of you as images of light, everything. These trees, bushes, the grass you are standing on, all are made of that light. You have no idea how beautiful everything is.